have to start off with a disclaimer. Even though it's the economic sustainability, I'm not an economist, but the other two authors are, so I'll try not to butcher up their vernacular too much. The whole session, we're looking at different sustainability aspects, as you notice the word in a lot of the presentations, and probably one of the biggest sustainability aspects is going to be economic, because if you can't demonstrate to growers the economics, then they're not going to make the change on the land. So it's really an area that we need to put at the forefront. And really for it to take off, the production of cellulosic biofuel is really a precondition in order to get that large-scale biofuel production that the renewable fuel standard is demanding. And one thing history has made clear, to really get the change on the land, it takes more than just showing a profitable crop. You really have to compete against the most profitable crop. And so that's what we're going to try to do with some of these analyses here. And that's really what it both the last two are kind of getting at. And when you put that in economic terms, they have, if you look at this graph here, this graph, this line here would be switch rest of corn and soy. So if we just keep it simple here and we take the return as $100 per acre, you can see, you know, if this was the return for that corn soy, you'd have to have almost 1.5 times that in order for that grower to switch to a different crop because of the risks that are inherent with a new crop. And the economists then call anything in between here kind of that inaction zone. And that's really what you have to overcome. You really have to be better than what's currently on the land to get that wholesale change on the land, at least from economist perspective. So how do land managers make choices? Well, of course, you know, they need to get over that inactive zone. And they look at things, number one, earn a living, enjoy a healthy, happy life. And this is through survey work that's done. Have that high probability of success. Leave something for the next generation. Those are all, you know, big ticket items for them. Then some of the limitations of what's really feasible as far as getting change on the land is what the farm resources are, what the farmer's knowledge is. That's, of course, where we come in. Then access to markets, which is a big thing for cellulosic, because that's not established yet either. So in general, as far as objectives, what we're attempting to answer here is, number one, how profitable are bioenergy crop systems expected to be? And again, I have to emphasize expected, because we're going to base this study on experiments that are just being put out on the land. So we haven't got our own economic data yet. Number one, we don't have a market for this stuff. And you know, and a lot of that just hasn't been developed. So we've had to use a lot of literature values for these figures. And I'll show you where that comes from as we go through. And then if these systems are not more profitable in continuous corn, then what price or what yield would we have to attain in order for them to become at least as profitable as continuous corn? And continuous corn is kind of our benchmark, our bellwether here that we're comparing against. So materials and methods, these are the eight model systems that we were using, and these are just on the land at Kellogg Biological Station, but we haven't had them there long enough to get the economic data. So we took these eight systems, and then we took basically the best available data that we had in terms of yields, prices, and so forth. But they're based on these systems that we currently have on the land. And what we wanted to do this now to give us kind of a benchmark, if you will. And then we'll go back after we have these systems mature, and we can compare the profitability at that point to based on what we expected them to be, and I'm sure there's going to be some changes. Just looking at the systems here, and they're based on a continuum of low diversity, high inputs, that'd be the continuous corn on one spectrum, to the high diversity, low inputs, which would be kind of prairie old field on the other. And then this gives a little bit of the background on each. I won't spend a lot of time because we're limited on each, but more on the methods, some of the economic things. We constructed capital budgets for each crop system over a 10-year period. Then we compared the analyzed costs and revenues across the systems. Then we calculated break-even prices and yield for each alternative system relative to that continuous corn system. Then assessed the likelihood of the adoption of those systems based on their expected profitability. The capital budgeting approach is standard economic analysis. It's what the economists call the return to land and management. All the other costs are in there, but if you keep that the same for all the treatments, you compare across the different systems. The price scenarios used were between 2006 and 2009 prices with yields that we would expect in the land in the area where we have these plots established. We assume typical agronomic management, which isn't always the case for the small plots. So when the question arose, we used what was typical for a commercial farm in that area. And then the annualized net return calculated with a 5% capital opportunity cost. Corn, soybean, canola rotation, we considered that as where a grower had an entry every year for each crop, so a third of their land was in each of those crops. A 10-year cycle for the miscanthus and switchgrass, where we ramped the yields up over time. And the poplar was a 10-year cycle with a one coppicing at the end of that 10-year, but the profit was kind of smooth, a nice economic term there, over those 10 years. These were the yields and prices, and you can see, I think, I'm not an economist, but being an agronomist, there are some things that I don't believe we're going to reach the 22 ton for miscanthus, but again, we used what we found in the literature. Switchgrass is probably going to be pretty close, and you can see what some of the other yields are, probably not too far off, but that's the one that I had the biggest question mark on. These are the crop input prices. Nothing really surprising there, I guess. For results, this first one, this is the one that I told you really didn't matter to farmers. This is just basically whether they make money or not. This is not comparing it against the other crop, but you can see continuous corn on there, corn, soybean, canola rotation, switchgrass. Then there's two miscanthus on there, one with what we call costly rhizomes. That's what we actually paid for rhizomes, which was $1.80 last year. The stuff we're trying to get this year is, I think, $2.30 a rhizome. And then we compared with what we could find online in Europe. You can buy it for a nickel a rhizome. So there's a real difference there. And you can see a tremendous difference in the graphs, too. This being with the costly. You can see we're losing quite a bit of money. Then with the cheaper ones, it actually came out very well. And then the grass mix made money, but we lost money with the poplar, the native prairie, and just pretty close to even with the old field. I should explain is just where you don't put any inputs in there and you take what you get. I guess every good farmer's nightmare, where you just let a field go and let it grow up and then take the biomass off of it. This would be the comparative break-even prices for dedicated cellulosic crops to replace continuous corn. And you can see on the bottom what this would be continuous corn compared it with these prices. And if you used to per bushel, it'd be $2.50, $3.50, and $4.50. So today, $3.50 probably fits. So use the red bar. And this would tell you what the comparative break-even price would be for switchgrass. This would be the costly rhizomes, the cheaper rhizomes, and so forth. And this is the comparative break-even yields. This is telling you the yield that you would have to have from each of these systems to break even with continuous corn. If the price of was set at $60 per ton for the biomass. And the corn system that we're comparing it to is where you would take all the grain off, sell that, and then also harvest 38% of it for forage. So you can see we're not too far off. Then the red bar is the current yield. So the difference here is where we, what we would have to make up basically to make these pay. So we'd have to take switchgrass from 9 ton up to about 12, 13 in order for that to be profitable. And you can see for the costly rhizomes, it's probably not going to happen there. We'd have to have 126 ton per hectare there. But you can see we're not too far off on a lot of these systems. And then the miscanthus with the European prices for the rhizomes, that one actually, you know, already exceeds, given those economic parameters, would already exceed the continuous corn. Just another way to look at it, this is the percent yield increase over the current benchmarks required for the dedicated cellulosic crops at different prices per ton of the material. And again, you can see the percent yield increase that you would need about 50%, you know, with the current at the $60 a ton. And of course, if you up the price, then you need less out there to match up with the continuous corn. The purpose of this is just to kind of show you where the input costs are. You can see certainly with the annual crop systems, a lot more of your input costs are going to be in fertilizer. With the miscanthus, a lot of it with the costly rhizomes here was in the actual seed stock itself, which greatly diminished at the European prices compared to what the input costs were for some of the other systems. So in conclusion, current perennial dedicated cellulosic biomass crops with the current production and the input costs and the price for the product do not compete very well with continuous corn with the current price structure. The one exception was that miscanthus with the cheap rhizomes, but remember again that was based on that 22 ton yield, which I guess we'll find out next from Emily whether that's feasible or not. But we're not sure in Michigan whether we're going to be able to get that or not. Maybe in Iowa and Illinois. The potential for that profit production of dedicated crops may be greater on non-crop land, where your opportunity cost for that land is going to be less. And we think there's a lot of things that are kind of pointing in that direction. We don't think that the biomass is going to compete very well for the good land when you're compared to food prices, what you're going to be producing on that. So we think a lot of that production is probably going to be shifted towards these marginal soils, where it will be a little more competitive because of the different cost structures there. And also the other big thing that's going to change in this whole in the equation would be efficiencies in bioprocessing conversion costs. As that comes down, that'll make that feedstock a lot more attractive as well than what it is currently. So future work on this, as I alluded to, this is really kind of going to establish our benchmark from where we're starting at with the economics. And as we get these cropping systems up and running, we're going to monitor the economic aspects of those and then hopefully do a comparison as the technology evolves and as the agronomy evolves for producing them also. And then compare those results with literature values and then also identify the crop system areas that need improvements in efficiency. So with that, if there's any questions? Yep.
Plenty of time for questions.
So these cases imported from Europe, do they have any, you know, restriction because they're exotic, you know, alien species?
Yeah, I don't think you can just, without the proper permits, you can't just bring it in. And that's part of the difference why they're able to draw, you know, $1.80, $2.30 a rhizome here compared to the 5 cents over there.
Because there's a potential bottleneck, of course, and in future, you know, in a regulation issue.
Yeah, yeah.
Massively.
Yep, yeah, no, I would agree. I don't think that, I think there are a couple things that will probably happen on that front. You know, there are groups that are working on seed proliferation of it, not having a triploid variety out there that you can reproduce from seed, which would be a huge cost savings for the farmer. But then you have some questions about invasiveness and other things that have to be addressed yet with that crop. So there's still some question marks. I'm sure the next speaker is going to get at some of those issues too. Yes, sir.
I'm curious how you can think about doing this campus at 22 tons without any fertilizer. I mean, you don't really, didn't show a cost for fertilizer. I mean, if you grow a grass with that high yield, let's put it on forage crops.
Yeah, and that's why I singled out that crop, as saying that's probably going to be a fundamental difference between what our literature value stuff is showing versus what our actual is going to show. Because, you know, most people in this room come from an agronomic background, and we don't make something out of nothing. But we went, and staying true to the objectives of the study, we were going to use what literature values that we had out there.
Same applied to switchgrass, even at, what, 12 to 14 tons. You're going to need more fertilizer than you applied in that analysis.
Yeah, switchgrass, we've got a little bit of little more experience with, and on our better soils, around 70 pounds per acre, we've gotten the 10 ton yields.
I don't think that's sustainable though, because you are.
Yeah, we may be depleting some of the existing nitrogen but it's certainly going to have a better. We expect a better nitrogen use efficiency than we would have with an annual crop.